It's 10 o'clock, Greenwich Mean Time. This is the BBC World Service, and I'm Stuart McIntosh with Newsdesk. The headlines: the former South African president, F.W. de Klerk, who oversaw the transition to democracy in the country, is retiring from politics. Russian space officials say the cosmonauts aboard the space station Mir have resolved the latest problems with the oxygen system, which had threatened the future of the mission. A special debate is taking place in the Indian Parliament to review 50 years of independence and to consider the challenges that lie ahead. Also in this edition, the Chinese Prime Minister Li Peng tries to reassure Southeast Asian nations that his country is not an economic threat, and a warning by environmentalists that a dramatic rise in temperature in the Arctic is threatening the existence of polar bears. The former president of South Africa, F.W. de Klerk, will today announce his resignation as leader of the National Party and from politics. Senior party sources have told the BBC that the announcement is due to be made at a party meeting which is now underway. Mr. de Klerk became party leader in 1989 after holding key posts in the apartheid government. But the following year, he announced sweeping reforms and released Nelson Mandela from prison. From Johannesburg, here's Richard Downes.
F.W. de Klerk will today tender his resignation from the party and from active politics, according to a senior source in the National Party. Mr. de Klerk has given no reason so far for his decision, but the National Party ruling council is meeting at the moment to consider his request that he retire from running the party. Mr. de Klerk led South Africa through one of its most difficult periods in history, negotiating an end to apartheid, releasing Nelson Mandela, and contesting the country's first democratic elections in 1994. But since then, his popularity in the country has waned. He has been criticized by many for his party's contribution to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the body looking into the political crimes of the past. Many political activists have said that Mr. de Klerk and his party have not yet fully apologized for the crimes committed during the apartheid era. Earlier this year, Mr. de Klerk's most senior aide, Rolf Meyer, resigned from the party to set up a political movement of his own. There is now likely to be a battle between the radical right wing and liberal elements within the National Party for the leadership. The current hot favorite to replace F.W. de Klerk is Hernus Kriel, the right-wing leader of the National Party from Cape Town.
Richard Downes reporting. Now, with an assessment of Mr. de Klerk's political career, here's our foreign affairs correspondent, Fergus Nicol.
F.W. de Klerk will go down in history as one of the few leaders with the combination of pragmatism and courage to engineer their own political demise. But he hasn't tried to regain his old seat at the top. Unlike Mikhail Gorbachev, the former Soviet premier who won less than 1% of the vote in last year's presidential election, or Kenneth Kaunda, Zambia's strongman for 27 years, who's still to be found in the thick of political battle. And Mr. de Klerk, who shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Nelson Mandela, has shown few signs of regretting his momentous initiative, of which he gave his National Party colleagues fair warning when he took over as leader in 1989.
The watershed at which South Africa finds itself demands of all our people a commitment and the will and determination to reach a peaceful accord.
Not that it's been easy for him. He's had to endure accusations of treachery from the further extremes of South Africa's white population. Since resigning as deputy president last year, Mr. de Klerk has played his part as an opposition leader, trying to establish the National Party as an effective force to counter the powerful ANC. President Mandela has already paid a somewhat cautious tribute to his predecessor, saying, whatever mistakes he may have made, and it is possible that he's made very fundamental mistakes, as many of us have done, I hope South Africa will not forget the role he has played.
Fergus Nicol. A senior official of the International Monetary Fund has said that President Moi of Kenya is very determined to stamp out corruption and to enhance good government. The official, Rima Carstens, who is part of the IMF team in Kenya to discuss a resumption of aid, was commenting on his talks on Monday with Mr. Moi in the coastal city of Mombasa. The IMF suspended a $200 million loan to Kenya last month because of concerns over corruption. Mr. Carstens said the IMF team was not in Kenya to negotiate, but to agree a start date for new talks once key issues had been dealt with. The chiefs of staff of armed forces from all over West Africa are meeting in the Nigerian capital Abuja for discussions before the summit on Thursday of the regional grouping ECOWAS. One issue they're expected to consider is the West African military presence in Liberia and the future of the force once its mandate expires in 6 months' time. Our West Africa correspondent, Elizabeth Blunt, reports from Abuja.
The West African regional body ECOWAS started life as an economic grouping, but nowadays gold-braided uniforms mingle with the dark suits and African robes at its annual meetings. Almost by accident, ECOWAS has developed a military wing, a force set up in 1990 to intervene in the chaotic fighting in Liberia. 7 years later, that hastily created force still exists, but it's coming to the end of its mandate now that Liberia has an elected government. Its final task will be to help create a new national army before pulling out in 6 months' time. One of the tasks before the chiefs of staff is to look at the last part of the mandate, the plans for creating the new army, and whether they can be completed in the time allowed. But there's also the broader question of the force's own future, and whether it will simply vanish from existence when the Liberian mandate expires.
Elizabeth Blunt reporting from Nigeria. You're listening to News Desk in the BBC World Service. Russian officials say the crew aboard the space station Mir have managed to repair two of their systems for generating oxygen after a failure that left them with limited supplies. Officials at Mission Control in Russia said that both the main system and a backup were now working and there was no threat to the crew or their normal work. Andrew Harding reports from Moscow.
There was a serious oxygen problem on board Mir, but it's now been fixed. A spokesman for Russia's Mission Control confirmed that both the main and the backup oxygen-generating systems had broken down on Monday night. For several hours, the crew were in real trouble. With only a few days' supply of oxygen left, they could have been forced to abandon their accident-prone station. But a Russian official, Sevolod Latushin, said both systems had now been fixed and were working fine. Mission Control has been in touch with the crew again on Tuesday morning. The three men have had a good night's sleep. They're now pushing ahead with other crucial repair work, trying to boost power supplies from the damaged Spectre module, testing out a third oxygen generator, and preparing for next week's spacewalk. Mir has been having regular trouble with its oxygen systems recently. In February, one of them burst into flames, sending smoke pouring through the station. News of the latest problems was released by NASA and caused some confusion when the Russians initially denied that anything was wrong. A NASA official at Mission Control said Mir's oxygen levels were now fine.
Andrew Harding in Moscow. Russia opens talks with Ukraine today on European security issues and military and technical cooperation as Ukraine continues to host joint naval exercises on the Black Sea involving American NATO warships. The Russian Defense Minister, Igor Sergeyev, who's heading the delegation arriving in Kiev, has criticized the maneuvers as unjustified and unhelpful in building international trust. Correspondents say Russia has been angered by the decision to start the exercise in the Crimean port of Donyuslav, near the base of the Black Sea Fleet, and in an area with a largely Russian population. The Bosnian Serb president, Biljana Plavsic, is waiting to meet army leaders in a crucial test of her bid to wrest control of the republic from supporters of her predecessor, Radovan Karadzic. The army leadership has accused her of overstepping her authority, and on Monday it postponed a meeting in Mrs. Plavsic's stronghold in the town of Banja Luka. However, there is now reported to have been a split among the top commanders. Our correspondent, Orla Gerin, is in Banja Luka.
As much as anything else, President Plavsic is fighting to win over public opinion here. Securing the support of the army would be a major boost and a clear signal that she is cementing her position. In the army leadership, she has both supporters and opponents, and there are fears that the army could split. The president is widely expected to try to replace the chief of staff, who has publicly attacked her, with one of her own men. But she herself has been reluctant to make any predictions about which way the army will go. Slowly but surely, support for President Plavsic appears to be growing. She insists the power struggle here will end peacefully with a victory for her. But the president faces continuing opposition from the wartime leadership in Palais, loyal to Radovan Karadzic. The parliament there, which she has tried to dissolve, is planning to go into session for the next 2 days. This is an open challenge to her authority, It's clear her opponents are not prepared to give way just yet. But the president insists that Palais will eventually have to agree to new elections planned for October. If public opinion does move decisively her way, then the hardliners in Palais will have little choice but to agree.
That was Orla Guerin. Still to come in this news desk, one of the finest athletes to emerge from the United States over the past two decades gives his thoughts in a BBC interview before paying his farewell to Europe. But first, today's main headline again. The former president of South Africa, F.W. de Klerk, who oversaw the country's transition to democracy, is retiring from politics. He'll make the announcement at a political meeting which is underway now. Now the rest of the news. A special session of Parliament in India called to debate the achievements and failures during 50 years of independence has been told that it now faces a second freedom struggle against poverty, illiteracy, intolerance and many other problems. The Speaker of the Lower House, P.A. Sangma, made a stirring call for action to address the internal contradictions of India, including the persistence of widespread poverty amid growing prosperity. Daniel Lack reports from Delhi.
A well-mannered and orderly lower house sat quietly as the Speaker, P.A. Sangma, made what he jokingly termed his maiden speech to Parliament. The Speaker doesn't usually address Parliament in India except on procedural matters, but this special four-day session on the achievements and failures of Indian democracy was Mr. Sangma's idea. His speech was blunt, hard-hitting and wide-ranging. He listed many of the problems facing modern India: illiteracy, poverty, environmental degradation, political violence, alienation of ethnic or economic groups, and the challenges posed by attempts to make the country a global economic player. Mr. Sangma said he was giving members of Parliament points of discussion, and he hoped they would address them in a politically non-partisan way. The country's soaring population was identified as one of its most acute challenges by the Speaker, as well as pollution caused by growth in industry and agriculture. His conclusion was a stirring call for what he termed a second freedom struggle against India's internal contradictions. He identified these as the growing prosperity of those who benefit from economic change versus the poverty of at least 40% of the population. Also, the Indian tradition of tolerance in diversity versus growing violence and intolerance in many parts of the country. MPs are being given the chance to address the House over the next 4 days on these and other issues. Many have been preparing their speeches for weeks. It remains to be seen if they meet the Speaker's challenge of keeping party politics out of the debate and coming up with real answers to the many questions he has asked them.
Daniel Lack in Delhi. The human rights organisation Amnesty International has expressed concern about the rising number of executions in China. Amnesty says Chinese courts handed down more than 6,000 death sentences last year, 4,000 of which were known to have been carried out. It said a national campaign against crime known as Strike Hard had put courts under intense pressure, with the result that justice had become hurried and punishment arbitrary. China says the death sentence is used sparingly. The Chinese Prime Minister Li Peng has dismissed as baseless fears expressed in parts of Asia that China's rapid economic growth would turn it into a military threat. Speaking at the end of a visit to Singapore, Mr. Li said that economic development had not been evenly spread, and it could take another 50 years for China to become an even moderately strong country. From Singapore, here's our Southeast Asia correspondent, Simon Ingram.
Concern about the challenge posed by a newly assertive China has been current for some time, not least in Southeast Asia, where several countries are embroiled in long-running territorial disputes with Beijing. In a briefing with local journalists in Singapore, Prime Minister Li Peng said that the so-called China threat theory was totally baseless. He said that although China had achieved a rapid rate of economic expansion, the development had not been evenly spread, and many of its citizens were still living in poverty. It could take 50 or more years, Mr. Li argued, for China to become even a moderately strong country. This reassuring message was one the Prime Minister developed in a speech to Singapore's business community on Tuesday. He said the bilateral agreements China had concluded with most Southeast Asian countries in trade and investment needed to be extended to cover cooperation in infrastructural development, environmental protection, and what he termed poverty alleviation. Such collaboration, Mr. Li argued, would be conducive to peace and stability in the whole Asia-Pacific region.
That report by Simon Ingram. On the business front, China has meanwhile announced that it'll keep its massive telecommunications market closed to foreign firms for the foreseeable future. It will, however, still need capital from abroad to finance expansion. For more on that and the rest of the business news, here's Sally Hardcastle.
Telecom companies hoping to gain a share in China's telecommunications market have been told bluntly they'll have to wait. A Chinese government minister has said foreign businessmen can't share in profits that were brought through government policy. But money from abroad will be needed to finance the spreading telecoms infrastructure. And there's pressure for liberalisation from the World Trade Organization, which China is negotiating to join. Markets in Tokyo, the Nikkei average is up 158 at 18,814. London's 100 share index is down 34 at 48.67. The dollar is worth 1 German mark 80 and 118 Japanese yen. The pound is at $1.61.
That was Sally Hardcastle with the business news. Parliament in Cambodia has begun debating a bill aimed at depoliticising the armed forces, which are currently highly factionalised with troops supporting rival parties. Under the bill, members of the armed forces would be banned from party membership and not allowed to join trade unions or take part in demonstrations and strikes. Meanwhile, King Sihanouk has said he'll return to Cambodia on Friday from Beijing, where he's been having medical treatment for the last few months. Government ministers from Britain and the Irish Republic are to meet in Belfast today to discuss the resumption of multi-party talks on the future of Northern Ireland in September. It's expected that the British Northern Ireland Secretary and the Irish Foreign Minister will try to finalise details of an international body which will deal with the issue of decommissioning weapons held by paramilitary groups. Our political correspondent Adam Brimelow has this report.
The handing over of paramilitary weapons has been the main obstacle to political progress in Northern Ireland over the last year. The British and Irish governments have proposed that an international body should address the issue in parallel with political talks. The plan was rejected by unionist politicians because they feared it would allow the IRA to retain its weapons while its political wing, Sinn Féin, was engaged in the negotiations. The British and Irish governments insist the schedule for the talks won't be affected, but they still hope to persuade the unionists to accept their plans through assurances that weapons will be handed over during the talks process. This will be the focus of today's discussions between Mo Molam and Ray Burke. The other key concern is the credibility of the IRA ceasefire. Mo Molam is consulting security officials in Belfast to decide whether it's genuine. She's indicated that she's pleased at the way it appears to be holding.
It's been, as I've said earlier, quite a positive situation up till now. But I want to listen to the security people later today because I want to make the judgment in the round. I want to look at all the factors and I want to make it carefully as the week goes on.
If she decides the ceasefire is genuine, then Sinn Féin will be allowed into the multi-party talks. It will also help to clear the way for a meeting between Sinn Féin leaders and the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, although that won't happen until the talks are underway.
Adam Brimelow reporting. Pro-Kurdish peace activists who intended to leave the Belgian capital Brussels today on a train journey across Europe to highlight the plight of Kurds in southeast Turkey say they'll now hold a protest rally in the city. The move follows the German authorities' decision to bar their passage. The protest organisers blamed the ban on what they called strong commercial links between Germany and Turkey and insisted that they would still send a contingent to Istanbul in the coming week. David Eads reports from Brussels.
The Musa Anta peace train, named after the Kurdish writer shot dead in southeastern Turkey 5 years ago, was intended to focus international attention on the Turkish government's treatment of the Kurds. Human rights activists from around 20 countries, along with leading lights such as Desmond Tutu, the playwright Arthur Miller, and Danielle Mitterrand, widow of the former French president, gave their names to the project, which plotted a route from Brussels across Europe and into southeastern Turkey. Despite an insistence from Ankara that the train would be stopped at the border, 500 activists planned to travel via Istanbul and Ankara, ultimately to the southeastern town of Diyarbakir, the end of their journey coinciding with International Anti-War Day next Monday. The Turkish government has consistently dismissed the peace train as a propaganda exercise by the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, with whom they've fought a long and violent conflict in the southeast for more than a decade. The political sensitivity has been acutely felt in Germany, where the PKK is banned as a terrorist organization, and where the Interior Ministry has refused permission for the German-hired train to carry foreign nationals across its borders. The organisers of the train have accused Bonn of encouraging the Turkish government to continue what they call its war in Kurdistan, a war Ankara does not recognise.
David Eanes. Exactly 100 years after the Zionist movement was born at a congress in Basel, the Swiss city is playing host to celebrations involving Jewish groups from around the world. The Basel authorities say they hope the centenary celebrations will help repair the damage caused by allegations that Switzerland colluded with the Nazis during the war and siphoned off Jewish assets in Swiss banks. The brainchild of a Viennese journalist, Theodor Herzl, the Basel Congress set the goal of what was described as a publicly and legally secured home for the Jewish people in Palestine, then part of the Ottoman Empire. But it was only after the Jewish Holocaust of the Second World War, 50 years later, that the State of Israel was born. Organisers of Pope John Paul's four-day visit to France say it's left the Roman Catholic Church there facing a deficit of $5 million. The organisers blamed the shortfall on young pilgrims, many of whom, they said, had left the World Youth Festival without paying for food and lodging. Church officials said that most of those attending had failed to pay their entry fee. You're listening to Newsdesk in the BBC World Service. It's just after 21 minutes past 10, Greenwich Mean Time. Prisoners at a jail in Brazil are holding 60 people hostage in a protest against conditions at a jail in the town of Mirandópolis, 600 kilometres from São Paulo. The hostages, mainly women and children, are relatives of the inmates who are demanding a transfer to other prisons. Jan Rocha reports from São Paulo.
Heavily armed riot police have surrounded the prison at Mirandópolis. The rebellion began as visiting time ended on Sunday afternoon. 40 women, 17 children and 3 men were taken hostage by a group of prisoners and held in the open courtyard where the visit had taken place. 24 hours later, one woman who was feeling ill was released, but the other 59 hostages faced their second night inside the prison. The rebel prisoners are demanding a transfer to other jails because of overcrowding. 800 men are held in a prison built for 600. A judge and prison service officials have been trying to negotiate the release of the hostages, so far without success. The chronic overcrowding in Brazil's prisons has led to scores of rebellions and escape attempts this year. In Brasilia, a judge has just ordered the early release of 160 men because they've less than the minimum legal space in their cells. In São Paulo, many prisoners held in police cells have to take it in turns to sleep or tie themselves to the bar so they can sleep standing up. To remedy the situation, the government has begun a prison building program and sent a bill to Congress to allow minor offences to be punished with alternative sentences, like services to the community.
Jan Rocha reporting from São Paulo. The publisher of one of the biggest newspapers in Mexico, El Universal, has been found guilty of tax evasion. The publisher, Juan Francisco Eali Ortiz, was given the choice of a fine of $3,000 or a 3-year jail sentence. The spokesman for the newspaper said Mr. Eali Ortiz did not accept that he'd done anything wrong and had not yet decided whether to pay the fine. Mr. Eali Ortiz said he's being targeted by the authorities because the newspaper has switched in the past year from being pro-government to adopting a more independent line. Thousands of polar bear cubs are said to be at risk in the Arctic because of global warming. An expedition by the environmental group Greenpeace has found that a dramatic rise in temperature has caused the ice the bears live on to melt, destroying their dens and exposing the cubs to the harsh Arctic conditions. The expedition leader, Steve Sawyer, said a reduction in sea ice could also threaten other Arctic wildlife such as seals and fish. Richard Black of our science staff reports.
A Greenpeace report notes two threats to polar bears. Firstly, the bears raise their cubs in ice caves. If the ice becomes unstable, the caves collapse and the cubs are exposed to harsh conditions too early in their lives. Secondly, the entire food chain is based on algae which live under the ice. If there's no ice, there are no algae and no food chain. This would affect other species such as fish and seals as well. The report, which has been compiled by scientists rather than activists, is the latest in a series of events which show how Arctic wildlife is threatened by global warming. Just before Christmas, thousands of reindeers died in northeastern Russia after a series of freak weather conditions. Other observers have noted effects on migratory birds and on some of the plants that eke out an existence in the extreme cold. It's been proven beyond reasonable doubt that the Earth really is warming up, though debate remains over the cause of that warming. It's also becoming clear that temperatures in the Arctic are rising considerably faster than the global average, and that wildlife will suffer greatly in the unfamiliar warmth.
That report by Richard Black. The government in New Zealand has said that a deadly rabbit virus has spread to the country and could have been introduced deliberately. The chief veterinary officer for the Ministry of Agriculture said that rabbit calcivirus disease, or RCD, had been found on the South Island. He said it appeared to have been introduced by people wanting to cut the rabbit population, a month after the authorities decided not to use it for that purpose. Farmers have been pressing for the virus to be introduced because of the environmental damage caused by rabbits, which infest more than half of New Zealand's land area. The virus is widespread in Australia, where it took hold in 1995, and is expected to wipe out 60% of the 300 million rabbits there. In sport, one of the legends of athletics, Carl Lewis, makes his final competitive appearance in Europe later today. The American, who's won 9 Olympic titles, will appear in a 4x100m relay race at a Grand Prix meeting at the Olympic Stadium in Berlin. In a BBC interview, Lewis has made it clear that he doesn't think sport's world governing body, the International Amateur Athletics Federation, is doing enough in the fight against drug takers.
I wish that the sport as a whole could make a total commitment to cleaning up against drugs, and because the sport has not taken that commitment. And I think that the bad part about that is that it creates a cynicism that permeates throughout the entire sport. And I think that's the one thing you have to do, is take a stand and say what you believe. But the sport has to want to have a clean sport, or it's not going to happen. I mean, they're not getting the job done, the IAAF. They're not making the effort 100%, and neither is USA Track and Field. So until they make the commitment and until the athletes in the sport can stand up and speak their minds, the ones that are going to be in it, you're not going to see any changes.
Why don't these governing bodies want to make the effort then?
You know what? To be honest, I have no idea. I don't know why. You would think that from a credibility standpoint, from a public standpoint, and from just the fact of being fair and wanting more people to be involved, you would want a clean sport. But apparently they don't. Certain people will take drugs. There is a study that says that about 85% of the people that take performance-enhancing drugs also take recreational drugs. So that tells you it's a drug problem, much more so than, let's say, oh, I'm going to be fast and make a lot of money. Most people, that's not guaranteed. They don't know that.
The American athlete Carl Lewis talking there to our sports reporter Gary Richardson. Now to End News Desk, a look at the main points in the news again. The former president of South Africa, F.W. de Klerk, who oversaw the country's transition to democracy, is retiring from politics. He's making the announcement at a political meeting which is underway now. Russian space officials have confirmed American reports that the main oxygen-generating system and a backup system on board the space station Mir broke down for several hours. Russian mission control said the problems had now been fixed and the crew were in no danger. The Bosnian Serb president, Biljana Plavšić, is waiting to meet army leaders in a crucial test of her bid to wrest control of the republic from supporters of her predecessor, Radovan Karadžić. The army leadership accused her last week of overstepping her authority. Parliament in India is holding a special debate on the past 50 years of independence and the challenges that lie ahead. The health of democracy and economic reforms are among the issues being discussed. And the environmental group Greenpeace says thousands of polar bear cubs are at risk in the Arctic because of global warming. It says an expedition has found that a dramatic rise in temperatures is melting the bears' dens. For the past 30 minutes, you've been listening to News Desk in the World Service of the BBC.